So he spent last night very cold, and he sent a few messages saying, I'm really, really cold. Luckily, because he's so high up, the crane actually caught the first morning sun. So he was the first person to actually warm up. But now he's suffering from the heat because obviously there's no shade.
As supporters cheered Mr. George's successful landing, he was unable to speak directly to us, as any media talks after this action could affect his possible court battle to come.
So there you have it. Nick is back down safe and sound. But the battle will not end here. After a visit to hospital, Nick will likely be brought in for questioning by the police and potentially even charged for some of the conduct over the past couple of days. Then could come a lengthy court battle, which Nick will have to fight against as well. But the lessons that can be taken from this is that the activists behind these brave actions know the consequences, but they still do it anyway, meaning that until there is a solution for the oppressed Palestinian people, this type of action will continue to occur, not just in the UK, but worldwide, possibly as well. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters said the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new conflict for defending al-Quds and al-Aqsa Mosque. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Marib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Marib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Marib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Marib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is a proof.
Observers said the U.S. aid plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al-Bayda and Marib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s and there is anarchy. Civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks, such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh.
This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul.
In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least 7 Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for Western Kabul or approve People's Security Plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warn of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The heat wave gripping western United States is simultaneously breaking hundreds of temperature records, exacerbating a historic drought and priming the landscape for a summer and fall of extreme wildfire. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Manvi Singh. The piece is titled, Potentially the Worst Drought in 1,200 Years, Scientists Under Scorching U.S. Heat Wave. Heat wave currently gripping southwestern United States is simultaneously breaking hundreds of temperature records, exacerbating a historic drought and priming the landscape for a summer and autumn of extreme wildfires. Salt Lake City hit a record-breaking 107 degrees Fahrenheit, 42 degrees Celsius, while in Texas and California, power grid operators are asking residents to conserve energy to avoid rolling blackouts and power outages. And all of this before we've even reached the hottest part of the summer. Among the 40 million Americans enduring the triple-digit temperatures are scientists who study droughts and the climate. They'd long forewarned of this crisis, and now they're living through it. The Guardian spoke with researchers and academics across Western United States about how they're coping with the extreme heat wave. Kathleen Johnson, an associate professor of Earth System Science at the University of California at Irvine, said, "I feel a little bit lucky because I'm in Orange County, relatively close to the coast, so the temperatures are not as severe here as they are in other parts of California and Western United States. I'm worried about this summer. This doesn't bode well in terms of what we can expect with wildfire and a worsening drought. This current drought is potentially on track to become the worst that we've seen in at least 1,200 years. And the reason is linked directly to human-caused climate change. As a paleoclimatologist, my main point always is that we're able to look into the past. By looking at tree rings and other paleoclimate records, we're able to gain really important perspectives about how climate has varied and changed in the past. And having done that, it's clear that what we're experiencing now is not natural. This is undoubtedly being caused by human activities, by greenhouse gas emissions. The more we see these extreme events piled on top of each other, and not just in the Western United States, but globally, the more I think the reality of climate change becomes inescapable. And it feels absolutely overwhelming and sad, and we're going to have less water, increased wildfires, and more extreme heat waves. But it's also motivating. We need to continue to push for urgent action on climate change. Daniel Swain, a climate scientist, Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at University of California at Los Angeles, said, "This is really, really bad. Here on the eastern side of the Rockies, here in Boulder, Colorado, we're seeing record high temperatures. That's the case in other parts of the state and in other states. And we're seeing smoke plumes, not from local fires, but from fires in Arizona and Utah. I think for a lot of people, it's traumatic. The fires we saw in the last couple of years were really awful, and this year it seems like we're on the same trajectory. It kind of feels like deja vu. It does get rough sometimes talking about these things year after year. I live in the West, and all my family pretty much lives in the West. Most of my friends live in Western United States. It's where I grew up, and seeing the landscape scale transformations that are happening here and seeing how it's affecting people is overwhelming sometimes. But actually, to me, the most distressing part is that this is very much in line with predictions. Climate scientists have been repeating essentially the same messages and the same warnings since before I was born. Climate change is a major contributor to, if not the dominant factor, in a lot of the changes that we're seeing out in Western United States and elsewhere. And it just is going to keep getting worse unless we do something about it. And so far, you know, we have yet to do the kinds of things on a large enough scale that are actually going to make a meaningful difference." Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist and chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy in Texas, said, "The extreme heat and the wildfires aren't surprising, but it is just surreal to see what you only ever saw before in your research studies and models actually happening now in real life. And you're almost dumbfounded by the speed at which your projections have become reality. Climate change is loading the weather dice against us. We always have a chance of rolling a double six naturally, and getting an intense record-breaking summer heat wave. But decade by decade, as the world warms, it's as if climate change is sneaking in and taking one of those numbers on the dice and turning it into another six, and then another six, and maybe even a seven. So we're seeing that heat waves are coming earlier in the year, they are longer, and they are stronger. Still, public opinion data shows that there's a disconnect, where even though about 72% of the people in the United States say global warming is happening now, only 40% say they think that it will affect them directly. But we actually did a recent study looking at climate and weather extremes, and we found that really hot, dry conditions are the only thing that most people in the United States directly connect to climate change. So right now is a really important time for scientists to communicate with the public that climate change is here, it is now, and climate action matters.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining me again on today's episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we've been blessed once again with this opportunity to create little reminders for ourselves that would act as a shining lantern in the path of life to help us guide, to create guidance for ourselves through the words of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam and the Holy Quran, for us to be able to better ourselves in our interaction and treatment of others, and how we present ourselves in society. Because at the end of the day, we're social creatures, whether we like it or not, whether we're introverts or extroverts, whether we're outgoing or whether we are, or whether we enjoy our own company over others. It's the truth of life, and it's important as Muslims and the followers of the school of the Ahlul Bayt and the Ummah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam for us to equip ourselves with the best etiquette when it comes to treating other people and interacting with them. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was known for being incredibly approachable, very good at having very good, well-built social skills. He was lenient with the people around him, whether they were his enemies or his friends. He was humble and eloquent in his speech. He was kind and compassionate and sympathetic toward his people. And all of these are important for us to learn from and pick up, because the Quran tells us, verily, in the Prophet of Allah is the best example for human beings. One of the instances where that we have to definitely learn from the ethics and the akhlaq of the Noble Messenger of Allah is in regard with his treatment of the elderly. So how about we listen to a short little story, as the tradition of the lantern holds, regarding this matter, and we're going to be right back, so please stay with us. Mm-hmm.
Today we have an interesting story entitled The Old Lady and the Teller. An old lady handed her bank card to the teller and said, "I would like to withdraw $10. The teller told her, "For withdrawals less than $1,000, please use the ATM." The old lady wanted to know why. The teller returned her bank card and irritably told her, "These are the rules. Please leave if there is no further matter. There is a line of customers behind you." The old lady remained silent for a few seconds and handed her card back to the teller and said, "Please help me withdraw all the money I have." The teller was astonished when she checked the account balance. She nodded her head, leaned down, and respectfully told her, "Ma'am, you have more than $1 billion in your account, but the bank doesn't have that much cash currently. Could you make an appointment and come back again tomorrow?" The old lady then asked how much she could withdraw immediately. The teller told her any amount up to $3,000. "Well, please let me have $3,000 now." The teller kindly handed $3,000 in a very friendly way and with a smile to her. The old lady put $10 in her purse and asked the teller to deposit $2,990 back into her account. So we have a moral code here. Don't be difficult with old people. They spend a lifetime learning the skill.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we read, "Verily, respecting the elders and the white beards of a society is part of glorifying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." There are other groups of people that whom respect for is equivalent to glorifying Allah, like those who know the Quran, experts in the Quran, and the just leaders. But the focus today is the ijlal, the respect and to respect and to revere the elderly, right? In my understanding, the reason for the emphasis our religion puts on the importance of respecting our elderly can be a number of things. Number one, it would naturally be the result of a great sense of compassion and sympathy within a human being. If a person can respect the elderly, like genuinely respect them, right? Make them feel good about themselves, help them, understand them, listen to them, support them, and things of that ilk, it means that that person possesses a higher intelligence and a higher emotional intelligence and a higher touch of humanity in them. They've come to this understanding that this elderly person, who's their grandma, their grandpa, their great aunt, their neighbor who's retired and whose family and children have moved away and now he's all alone with his cat, or the old janitor at their office or their school, any of that. They've understood that this person wasn't born 75, right? They weren't born as this frail, sometimes absent-minded, almost senile weak, wrinkly, shriveled little human being. They once had a life. They carry a great weight of memory and life experience and ups and downs on their now frail and weak, narrow little shoulders. They once loved and they once lost and they've been hurt and they've laughed from the bottom of their heart and they've had their heart broken and they've been disappointed and they've achieved great success and they've had regrets in their lives and they've had repentances and they have moments that they are incredibly proud of or moments that they never wish to be reminded of ever again. They've been through all of that. And that in and of itself is very valuable, to have this vessel that carries in it all the potentials, all the capacities of a human life, for them to have lived all those years that we think we're promised, for them to have gained all those experiences that we have yet to gain, for them to be able to look us in our eyes, our still fresh, sparkling eyes filled with hope and desire and ambition, and tell us, been there, done that. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
the limelight.
UK's Downing Street came under renewed pressure to ditch Prime Minister Boris Johnson's controversial planning reforms, which many backbenchers blamed for the humiliating loss of the Buckinghamshire seat. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Peter Walker, and Aubrey Allegretti, under the heading, Senior Tories Warn Boris Johnson Blue Wall is at Risk After By-Election Defeat. Senior Conservatives have warned Prime Minister Boris Johnson a swathe of seats in the Blue Wall across the south of England could be at risk, as his party was gripped by recriminations in the aftermath of the Liberal Democrats' shock victory in the Chesham and Amersham by-election. Downing Street came under renewed pressure to ditch Boris Johnson's controversial planning reforms, which many backbenchers blamed for the humiliating loss of the Buckinghamshire seat. The by-election saw a historic 25% swing to Ed Davies' Liberal Democrats, enabling their newest MP, Sarah Green, to overturn a 16,000 majority in a constituency that had been Conservative since it was created back in 1974. A Tory MP representing a south-eastern seat said the upset was worrying, and that the Liberal Democrats had shown they could successfully rally voters against the government's planning reforms, which would strip powers to object to developments away from local residents. They said, there is going to have to be some consideration about either combating that messaging or changing the policy. Backbench rebels now believe that they have the numbers to defeat the legislation in its current form, though the bill is unlikely to come to the House of Commons until the autumn. Fears are also running high in local government, with one Tory source warning Number 10 needs to wake up quickly to the fact that its build, build, build agenda is going to destroy the home county's Blue Wall. Speaking at a victory rally in a Chesham community hall on Friday morning, the Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davies said, "Do you know what? I think there are many Conservative MPs across the country who are now worried." He said, "People have been talking about the Red Wall. I think that after Chesham and Amersham, they'll be talking about the Blue Wall and how the Liberal Democrats are the main threat to the Conservatives in huge swathes of the country." Reinforced the point in a very literal way, the Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davies stood for the television cameras in front of an actual wall made of blue plastic bricks and proceeded to knock it down with an orange mallet. Davies said there was quite a bit of anti-Boris feeling on doorsteps and concern about the direction of the Conservatives under Boris Johnson's more populist and culture war-focused leadership. Davies said, "For them, the emperor has no clothes," adding, "Those sorts of traditional liberal Tories care about foreign aid, things like free school meals for poor kids, and worry about civil liberties, and they're just being ignored." Johnson himself rejected the idea that he had neglected the south of England in his bid to conquer seats such as Hartlepool, which the Conservatives took from Labour in a by-election last month. Calling the result disappointing, Boris Johnson said there were particular circumstances at play. Aides suggested he was referring to HS2, the high-speed rail line which passes through the nearby Chilterns. Speaking to Sky News, Boris Johnson claimed it was bizarre to accuse his party of being unpopular in the south of England, pointing to the fact that he had won the London mayoral election twice, and insisting the Conservatives are a great one-nation party. Prime Minister Johnson also defended the proposed planning changes, calling them sensible. He said, "What we want is sensible plans to allow development on brownfield sites. We're not going to build on greenbelt sites. We're not going to build all over the countryside. But I do think that young people growing up in this country should have the chance of home ownership. And that's what we're focusing on." One backbench MP involved in campaigning against the planning reform said it was nonsense to blame the loss on HS2 alone. He said it is related to planning. Those members of parliament who went canvassing and saw the reaction on the doorstep know this to be the case. We're being sent a message. Some Conservatives privately blamed complacency at Conservative headquarters for the loss of the previously rock-solid seat. But others pointed to Boris Johnson's stance on several issues, in particular the planning proposals. Robert Hayward, the Tory peer, told The Guardian, "It is clear that there will be a marked impact on Robert Jenrick's intended planning legislation, because the message will come back for the whole of the South East that this is what opposition parties are going to play on." One Tory aide admitted, "I don't think anyone in the Conservative campaign headquarters expected such a big win for the Liberal Democrats. They said building houses was important, but we shouldn't go against our core Tory voters in the shires, who could end up deserting us if we obsess too much on an unpredictable electorate in the Northern Red Wall. We won them over in 2019 with a mixture of Boris and Brexit. Next time could be very different." Former Conservative MP for South West Hertfordshire, David Goke, expelled from the party by Boris Johnson over Brexit, said, "There is a realignment going on in British politics and that has favoured the Conservatives. It gave them a big majority the last time around because the first stage of this was the fall of the Red Wall." But David Goke cautioned by saying, "There are a group of seats, up to 30 or 40, where the Conservative vote is not Johnsonian, considers the government to be pretty populist, not focused on the interests of taxpayers, not sufficiently pro-business, and that vote is soft and it's vulnerable." Highlighting Tory losses in the local area at recent local elections in very prosperous middle-class commuter areas, such as Hitchin, Harpenden and Bishop Stortford, he added, "The current trajectory of the Conservative Party is not particularly sympathetic to those areas, and the local residents are not particularly sympathetic to what the Conservative Party has become." The Liberal Democrats now have 12 MPs, 8 of them women. In her acceptance speech, Sarah Green, a marketing company owner, said, "Together we have said enough is enough, and we will be heard, and the government will listen." Labour's vote collapsed to just 622, behind the Greens on 1,480, suggesting Labour supporters had swung their weight behind the candidate most likely to beat the Conservatives.
Africa Today. Today's month of June marks the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The charismatic leader was revered in Iran and across the world, including in African countries. Now, the incarcerated leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, says the thoughts of Imam Khomeini have remained relevant even after his demise.
And the thought before this world is the thought of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini is alive because his thoughts are very relevant to this time.
Hello and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenya. Today we are focusing on the impact of the thoughts of Imam Khomeini in Africa and how he inspired African nations in their struggle against apartheid and neo-colonialism. So join us as our experts give us an incisive analysis on this subject.
Imam Khomeini in Africa. One of the stated goals of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, led by Imam Khomeini in 1979, was to fight against racism and to support people of color. Imam Khomeini fulfilled his promise immediately after the victory of the Islamic Revolution when he issued an order to cut off Iran's ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa. This decision inspired the struggle for freedom and emancipation in South Africa. After his release from prison, the late Nelson Mandela traveled to Iran 2 times, and in both trips, he met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Now, during his first visit to Iran in 1992, Nelson Mandela emphasized that Imam Khomeini was a source of inspiration for the South African people in their anti-apartheid activities. The leader of the Islamic Revolution recalls here on what transpired during his meeting with Mandela. Now, for more on how Imam Khomeini inspired the people of Africa, we are joined here by Ms. Suhaila Ibrahim Zakzaki, the daughter of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, the leader of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with us here today is Said Husseini, the director of Islamic Center for Africa. Thank you for accepting our invitation.
It's a pleasure.
So let's start off with Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki. Now, can you first tell us about your personal acquaintance with the thoughts of Imam Khomeini?
The Imam, primarily with how we view the Imam, is a very, as someone that is a role model and an example for us for what Islamic, an Islamic struggle looks like, a struggle to bring about an Islamic system looks like. Imam was probably one of the, or the only actually example of that that actually achieved success, because while there is many other who had Islamic revolutionary views and whatnot, with the revolution of Iran, that was the first time that we saw in this world a success of such thing in our time today, right? So Imam was that kind of is that kind of example for us to this day, and especially with his emphasis on Islam and politics and the fact that those are not two separate things, and also Islam in many other aspects of life, like economics and other aspects of life, government and everything.
Thank you very much, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, for that.
The starting point of Imam Khomeini's proximity to the people of Africa after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was his decision to cut off Iran's ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa. This has been touted one of the Imam's strategic decisions made even before the victory of the revolution. Imam had already said, if the revolution attains victory, we will ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Now, Mr. Husseini, as we know, immediately after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini ordered the cutting of ties between Iran and South African apartheid regime. Now, how did this move inspire the liberation movements in that country?
I was speaking to icons of the struggle in South Africa. I was speaking to Nelson Mandela himself. He was saying to me that when the Islamic Revolution in Iran was happening, we actually had all of our hopes lost before that. We were thinking it will be impossible for us to deal with the apartheid state. This state is not going to deem, and this state is not going to go away. We were thinking about other ways how to cope and all of that. But when the victory of Islamic Revolution happened, we said, if it is possible for Iranian to remove a regime which was 2,500 years rooted, we also in South Africa, we will be able to do the same to apartheid regime.
Mr. Hussein Nivea, the director of Islamic Center for Africa, stay tuned for more.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran, under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, created tremendous change for women. Iranian women are free to participate in various social, political, educational, and economic activities in conformity with Islamic tenets. One such recent example is Zahra Nemati, an Iranian female Paralympic and Olympic archer. She is now recognized as one of the most inspiring women in the world, winning the 2021 International Women's Day Recognition Award.
We have our own culture and specific dress codes and cannot abandon it because we believe in it. Me and my fellow female athletes proved that we can take part in world sports events with our special dress code and win medals.
The progress made by women in Iran has inspired Muslim women from other parts of the world. In Nigeria recently, an 8 months pregnant woman won a gold medal. Now she took part in the competition wearing the Islamic hijab. Now, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, how have Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on women in Islam contributed to the awakening of Muslim women in Africa?
Imam's revolution and the fact that he emphasized on the role of women in society in the Islamic revolution, subsequently in building the country when the revolution succeeded, and in his many writings about Muslim women's role in public society in Islam, that has directly affected a lot of people, I believe, throughout the continent, and definitely in some even ways may have affected others indirectly. But I believe that is one of that is definitely a very great contribution to the idea that Muslim women should participate in public Islamic life as well, not just pray and, you know, pay attention to their relationship with God and not have any say or in anything or even speak, let's say, about Islamic matters, which was a prevalent thought before that. And I believe that to this day, that is the case, that Imam's views on women still influence a lot of people throughout Africa.
Thank you, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, for that. Now we shall take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue with our discussion on the impact of Imam Khomeini's thoughts in Africa. Stay with us.
Imam Khomeini in Africa.
Imam Khomeini's message resonated well with Africans who are inspired by his firm stand against arrogant powers and unflinching support for the oppressed and downtrodden nations. An African Muslim scholar explains here on how Imam Khomeini inspired African nations. Let's take a listen.
Imam Khomeini, his relationship with Africa was on the basis of humanity, that an African person is a human being like other human beings.
he came with a very important terminology when he was talking to Africans and to other people about Africa by introducing a word, al-mustadhaf, which this particular terminology was almost forgotten, even though the Holy Quran in Surah Al-Qasas says clearly, وَنُرِيدُ أَنَّ مُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ. We want to make those people who are deprived on the land, to make them a'imma, leaders. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, came with this particular terminology to say that if you look at the world today, you will see two types of people. There are those who are oppressors and those who are oppressed. And oppressed are mustadha'af. So he was talking to people of Africa and other parts of the world as mustadha'af to tell them that, remember, Allah in the Holy Quran will want to make you as leaders, so wake up.
Well, Mr. Hosseini, African people are currently engaged in the struggle against yesterday's colonialists who are today's neo-colonialists. Now, how can the ideas and thoughts of Imam Khomeini be useful in this regard?
Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, taught the Iranian nation how to fight against Shah regime. If the people of Africa also take their lessons from Imam Khomeini, I think they are going to be more determined in their struggle against the new colonialism which is taking over Africa in all over the show. And that is the sense of independence, being themselves, studying more, extending their education, thinking about their destiny, and lean on their own capacity and their capabilities and their financial abilities, and work for their own nation, don't allow other people to interfere in their affairs. I think these are the principles that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, managed to teach the Iranian nation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hosseini, for that insight.
The African continent has the natural resources and commercial power to become the richest continent in the world. But oppression, bribery, and exploitation by the Western powers hinder its development. Neocolonialism is no doubt the number one problem to Africa's economic development. While it is true that African countries gained independence from the imperialist Western countries, but neocolonialism remains a major challenge.
Now, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, as an African, what lessons do you think African nations can get from Imam Khomeini in combating neocolonialism?
Well, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, I would say, is in a way almost parallel to the struggle against neocolonialism, considering at the time, let's say, the Shah in Iran, while an Iranian ruler over Iranian people, was heavily influenced by people from outside who wanted to benefit from that kind of influence and control over the Shah to their benefits, which is no different than what we see currently throughout the continent today. It's no different from that. It is pretty much exactly what neocolonialism is and what we are living through, what is our reality today. And so in the approach that Imam had to that, to standing up against that kind of system, I believe that we have a lot to learn from that, and we do look to that as an example in so many ways. Even with the Islamic movement in Nigeria, I believe we look to that heavily as an example and an inspiration.
Now, Mr. Hosseini, we have heard there Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki talking about how Imam Khomeini inspired the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Now, can you briefly elaborate on Imam Khomeini's role in the awakening and unity of Muslims in Africa?
Imam Khomeini, right from beginning, was that we are not Shias, not Sunnis, we are Muslims, we are striving toward Islamic revolution, Islamic